movie got 4.5 stars. Anybody saying anything negative is on that crack rock. Yeah.
Tell me something, by the way, you like music? What's going on, y'all? This is Chris and Casey of the Black Is Fam. How y'all doing?
What's up, everybody?
This is somewhat of a different show. We're going to speak on 12 Years a Slave, which you know, has been in the theaters a while, and there's been a lot of talk surrounding it. Didn't get a chance to get the full Black Is Break crew to do a discussion. And, you know, Casey shot me the idea. You know, we've been talking about wanting to just record she and I on some topics because, you know, as we do the roundtable, it's kind of hard to get everybody together as frequent as we would like. And we want to still keep we just want to keep putting out good product for y'all, keeping it consistent, hitting you with the topics that keep coming up all the time. And
yeah, we want to try to be more timely and touch on topics as they happen. But that doesn't mean we're leaving the roundtable out. We'll still get the family together from time to time and do our large podcast sessions, but we will be having more episodes with just the two of us.
Oh yeah. So this one, this is probably going to be the title. It may change or not, but when it's KC and I, this will be The Lion and the Ram.
We'll let you guys think about that, see if you can figure that one out.
Right, we want to thank you guys for supporting Black Is. We appreciate all the listeners and the feedback that we've gotten. And I want to give a quick shout out to Michael Flood at RockCity212 on Twitter. He hit us up last week saying Black Is Online. I'm surprised you guys didn't record a discussion on 12 Years a Slave. I've been waiting for your responses to it. Well, you're about to get it right now.
Yep.
Thanks for hitting us up, man.
Here you go, Mr. Flood. So 12 Years a Slave, starring Chiwetel Ejiofor, directed by Steve McQueen. This film, for me, right off the bat, this is an amazing piece of American cinematic history. I think everybody needs to see this film. Race does not matter. If you are an American, you need to see this film. Just based off of the fact that this is a slave narrative, an actual slave narrative, yeah, turned into a feature film. It is shot beautifully. It is well acted. It is beautifully directed. The story is compelling. There, for me at least, was not a dull moment. And I think that this film showed more so the psychological effects of slavery. We were having a conversation with my mother-in-law, Chris's mom, and she was saying, you know, it wasn't as violent as I thought it would be.
It wasn't.
Yeah, and I think most people would have that response. It's not as violent as we anticipate. And that's not to say there aren't scenes of violence. There right. are some hard scenes to watch. Mm-hmm. But you really are seeing the psychological impact of slavery on all sides of right. slavery. Not just to slaves, but slave owners, slave sellers, former slaves, slaves that have moved up in the social hierarchy, everybody is impacted. If you were an American during the time of chattel slavery, you were impacted by this institution.
Very much so. Yeah, this isn't, Django was more violent than this. My mom even thought that Roots was more violent than this.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great American film. It's a film. If you want to call it a black film or another one of them slave movies that Hollywood trying to do and all that.
Yeah, because there's so many.
Right. And we're gonna speak on that after we get through this portion. But, you know, it's a great film. And, you know, I heard the director, Steve McQueen, not the actor, the actual director, who is a black man.
He is a brother.
I heard him on the treatment on KCRW. Great interview. You guys should go check that out if you have seen the film or if you haven't, just to get an idea of where he was coming from when he put the film together. But yeah.
We'll have the link.
Mm-hmm. But done very well. And she said acting was great. The way he shot the scenes. I mean, just holding the camera on certain instances, you know, showing the scenes of New Orleans. He just captured everything so beautifully.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We don't want to give too much of the film away, but this definitely will be a bit of a spoiler. So if you have not seen the film and you plan on seeing it, I don't know how much of this podcast you want to listen to unless, you know, you want to get our perspective, but definitely go see it. I want to give an extra special shout out to one of the stars of this film. I mean, I would even argue she might have stolen this film a little bit. It was definitely her and Chiwetel's film. A sister named Lupita Nyong'o. She played the character of Patsy. Masterful actress.
Oh, beautiful.
Masterful actress. She and Chiwetel, they're, so her character is Patsy. Chiwetel's character is Solomon, aka Platt. We get to see their characters probably more often than not. And they're the slaves who we get to know the most, mm-hmm. as far as their experiences and their stories. She's wonderful. She's so wonderful that anything she's cast in here on out, I'm going to be curious about seeing. Like, she was that good. And for both of them, the way this film was shot, you know, dialogue and delivery of dialogue is one thing, but facial expressions and body language carried actors so far in this film. And both of them, as from facial expressions to body language, were amazing. Amazing. They had communication without words that was so powerful. I mean, I don't know. It would render you speechless.
Oh, very much so. Okay, first off, let's talk about this idea of the free blacks being sold into slavery, because right. that's what this particular story is about.
Right. So if you have no prior knowledge of this film, the background of this particular slave narrative is that this man, Solomon Northup, was a free black man living in Saratoga Falls, if I'm not forgetting. And basically, he was bamboozled. He was approached by two white men, and Chris and I are actually reading the actual narrative now. He was approached by two white men who were dressed dignified, and they came to him and said that they were circus performers or carnival performers. He was a musician, amongst other things. And I guess they told him that they had been asking around the city and looking for somebody who was a good musician to join their troupe for a couple of performances. And they were told he was the man to talk to. He said they gave every indication that they were trustworthy. You know, they set out a business plan that made sense. They took him on some performances to begin with so that he could see what it was going to be about. So it wasn't like a situation where they came, you know, they blindfolded him, they kidnapped him, and boom. It was a whole process of gaining his trust. And then once they gained his trust, they had a situation where they drugged him.
Yeah, like they roofied him or something.
Yeah, they were all out for dinner having drinks, and he had drinks, and they drugged him. And next thing he knew, he got sick, and then he's waking up in chains.
Right. Yeah, they take him up the stairs, put him in the bed, like, oh, man, you'll feel better. And then he wake up, and he's chained.
Yeah, chained in a dungeon somewhere. And the interesting part of the location of where he's chained is literally, like, it, first of all, he went from Saratoga, which is in New York, to Washington, D.C. with them. He's within miles of the White House.
Yeah.
You know, and that actually is true to the story. He speaks of that in the narrative, that the way this place was set up, the average onlooker would walk right past and not even notice that it was there. They would have no clue what was going on inside. And there was really no access, you know, no windows or anything where the captives were held, where if you even yelled out, somebody from the street could hear you. So it was positioned perfectly for the job that it actually was doing. But what the film and the narrative showcase is that this was a serious business during mm-hmm. this time. In the 19th century, capturing free blacks and selling them into slavery was like that underground slave market was a big deal. It was a big deal.
Right. Oh, you had to be. I mean, blacks were worth tons of money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which they kind of state in this movie about the debt that these owners take on by purchasing these Negroes mm-hmm. and, you know, the cost and what they're willing to go through, you know, for their property.
Yeah. In fact, money is a theme, I think, throughout the entire film, because I definitely understood how much wealth was accumulated off the backs of slave labor, how much the value of each slave was in regard to how much work each slave could do daily, what that meant as far as profit for the plantation owners, the kind of social economic positioning that gave a plantation owner. And so the theme of money and wealth to me is pervasive throughout the whole film.
The scenes where they show that, I mean, I love this movie just for the fact that it's all psychological. Mm-hmm. You get to see how the mentality of these white folk were back then, mm-hmm. and how we were straight property. Mm-hmm. Paul Giamatti as a what would his character be like?
He would be like a slave seller, basically. Yeah, like the black market slave trader. He's the one who orchestrates the kidnappings and sells the free people back into slavery or
Yeah. Or just slaves in general, it seemed mm-hmm. like. I mean, when he's having customers in there, in the way he's just describing these black folk, you know, like having them open their mouth, take their shirt off, look at how way he stands up, slapping his chest, you know, mm-hmm. like, oh, he's gone. This guy, you can get a lot of work out of him.
Yeah, and it's not the way we've seen a traditional slave auction block, the way that's usually depicted. Mm-hmm. Paul Giamatti's character in the movie, his name is Freeman in the movie, his setup is like a high class salon. You come into this house mm-hmm. that is laid out, and there's drinks and there's refreshments and there's slaves, you know, and they're naked and they're standing there. It's almost like you're in a museum mm-hmm. looking at art to buy.
Yeah.
You know, and you go from room to room and there's different offerings at different prices.
And he's a coal dealer. I mean, there's a scene where he has to split up the family, and that's where you meet Solomon, who goes by Platt at this point. That's his name that he's been given. His first owner comes in and wants to buy Platt and this woman with her kids.
Eliza.
Right, Eliza. And she's begging to not be separated from her children. Mm-hmm. And Platt's, the owner is like, sees what she's going through and is like, hey, can I, how much for the child? And he's like, Paul Giamatti's character is like, she's not for sale.
Yeah. And this is part of the reason why her child was not for sale. Her child was mixed raced. And so Paul Giamatti, being who he is, or Freeman, sorry, who he is in the film, he recognizes, I can get a lot of money for her, especially the older she gets. So he's just going to hold on to her for a while until her value goes up, and then he can sell her.
Because she just has no black features. I mean, and he says it. I mean, you're like, wow. And
right. Like, he's like, she's not thick-lipped and nappy-head like the rest of these beasts. She's going to be a real beauty.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like, wow.
And it's a trip. What's good about this movie, too, is that it gives us different storylines for some of the characters that we meet. So Eliza, what we find out about her, and this is also explained even in more detail in the narrative, she is a woman who was favored by her master, favored and fathered children for her master, including her daughter. Her son is from a different relationship. Her son is black, all black, just like her. Her master favored her, and upon his death wanted her to be freed, wanted her to be manumitted. But his daughter hated her. His daughter and his wife couldn't stand her, but the daughter especially. And when he died, his daughter came into power on the plantation and let her know, let Eliza know right away, you're not going to be freed. And so she found herself in a situation where basically she was led astray. She was told by, and this is coming from the narrative itself, she was told by the brother in the family, oh, Eliza, today's the day we're gonna go handle your papers, your manumittance. So she gets herself super dressed up. She gets her kids super dressed up in their finest clothes, and they go into town. And in actuality, she's taken to the holding pen for Freeman's, you know, black market slave trade. Mm-hmm. So, and it's interesting, when we meet her character, she's all gussied up. She's dressed mm-hmm. up. Her son, we meet her son independent of her. He's already in the pen. And he's screaming for her, yelling for her, not understanding his situation or his circumstances.
Okay, let's move on to the black versus niggers section of our discussion.
Okay. So, when Solomon is kidnapped and he's put in the holding pen, they are going to travel from DC. He and the other kidnapped free men. And mind you, it wasn't just free black people who were kidnapped. There were some slaves who were also kidnapped off. I don't know if they were away from their plantations.
Right, just runaways that got caught again. But
right. But somehow, you know, some of them were just, they were already slaves, already in debt to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And so it's a bunch of people kidnapped and they're put on a boat and they're going down south. And Michael K. Williams, who we all know from Boardwalk Empire, is one of the characters in the film. And he's talking with Solomon and another man and saying, it's more of us than them. We should just rise up and take this boat over and head on back.
Right.
And the other brother, who is a slave, but from another plantation, says, ah, like, we could. He was like, there's three of us who are black men. He was like, but everybody else in here is niggas. They're not going to fight back.
Right. And It's shocking. It takes you. It gives you a quick little. It hits you kind of hard. You're like, wow. Mm-hmm. You know, but you understand basically what he means is they don't want to fight. They've already been broken.
Right, and it was interesting and enlightening to know that this distinction of black people versus niggas is not a new phenomenon. This is how black folks probably looked at themselves for years. If you were born on a plantation. And if you actually get into the narrative itself, Solomon says, you know, there are slaves. When he was a free man, he interacted with slaves all the time because Southerners would bring slaves with them when they would come to the North. And, you know, the slaves would walk around and go to different places. He would get into conversations with them. He said a lot of time they would talk about slavery as if it wasn't something bad, as if, because there were certain responsibilities of life they didn't have to be concerned with. You know, they didn't have to worry about trying to make a living or provide for themselves. That was already done for them, he said. But there was always a time where somebody would ask, you know, what would be the best way for us to run away, or could you help us? Right. And he said he would never know how to respond because he knew what the repercussions of that would be. And they were always hesitant because there's a fear there. Like, you know, I don't actually want to be in this circumstance, but I don't know how to get out of it.
Right. Yeah, it was, you know, and in that scene, Michael K. Williams, of course, he doesn't make it that long in the movie. He was actually chained up when you first see him, mm-hmm. You know,
muzzled.
Yeah. In the sense that like, oh, this is a Negro that doesn't know to shut up or is trouble. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, like that the third brother that was there who was kind of always negative and, you know, this is just how it's going to be. Once the boat lands, he sees his original master, mm-hmm. and he completely changes.
Yeah.
And it's like, master! Ah!
Mm-hmm. And he went from a man to a boy immediately.
Yeah. And you see, you know, and they let him off the boat. And he basically, runs to his master like that's his father, mm-hmm. and hugs him and is like, oh, I'm so happy to see you. And
puts his head on his shoulder and everything. It was a trip.
Yeah.
It was a trip.
And the one person Solomon actually gets to know is gone.
Yeah.
So now he's back alone. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because Michael K. Williams gets killed and then this guy goes back with his master and doesn't give Solomon's character a second thought. He doesn't give him a second. He just runs off to his master and he's gone.
Yeah. And, you know, you see throughout the movie, Casey and I have discussed this. I'm not one to believe that it's just so simple as the house nigga and the field nigga mentality. And it's just that simple. There has to be a mixture of both in order for slavery to end or to get to that point. It wasn't just, well, all the house Negroes are just cool with life as it is and they don't want things to change. And the field niggas are always the ones who want to escape. It's always a mixture of both. I mean, you see the way a lot of the house Negroes are treated basically like shit. And a lot of the field ones are treated with somewhat of respect because of the amount of work that they can do.
Yeah. There's ills on both sides and dangers on both sides. And I think the film does a good job of depicting that as well.
The mentality of white folks. This was very enlightening. Yeah. I don't remember a movie ever showing this part of how white folk actually dealt with slavery mentally and emotionally and how that actually affected them.
Yeah.
But you see it with a lot of different characters with both of Platt's slave owners.
Mm-hmm. So Platt's character goes through three different slave owners, although one he's on loan to. So technically two different slave owners during his 12 years of being captured. And what I told Chris, I said, we often talk about post-traumatic slave disorder and the impact it has on Black people even to this day. But this film has helped me realize that post-traumatic slave disorder impacted white folks as well, and probably still does. Definitely still does in regards to any sort of prejudiced thoughts that folks have, like just innately have about people of other races, Black people specifically. So in this film, you have a good master and a wicked master, the nigger breaker, so mm-hmm. to speak. The good master is played by...
His name is Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah, that's the name. Benedict Cumberbatch. And he plays the good master.
His first master, the one who originally purchases him.
Right. And he recognizes quickly that there's something special about Solomon. He asks him, they're trying to, and mind you, again, they're in Louisiana. They're trying to get up one of the swamps to move some of the tobacco, but he's having a challenge with how to do it because the channel is so narrow. And Solomon breaks it down how it could be done. And he's like, wow, like I'm really impressed with your knowledge right. and your experience.
And he actually tells him that he's done this before and he worked, did some work like this up in New York or, you know, wherever during this period where he was free.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, wow, I mean, he's actually really sharing all this information.
Right. And it's interesting because on this particular plantation, Platt is kind of juxtaposed against this baby overseer named Tabeats. I think it's Tabeats. I forget how they didn't say his name often enough for me to remember it. But the character is played by an actor named Paul Dano, who I love. He always plays the sad, jacked up white boy. That's the pathetic white boy is his character.
Yeah.
And so it's obvious that Solomon is smarter than him. He can't stand it as a white man. And his problem is he needs to feel superior to his slaves. In fact, when we're introduced to him, he is meeting all the new slaves and he's singing like this kid's like a kid's song.
Yeah.
Like a nursery rhyme. But it's like all these niggas go running. Like it's something crazy and degrading. And all they can do is sit there and listen to him sing.
Yeah. And the director lets it play. I mean, it's almost like he sings the whole song.
Yeah. It's on for a good 4-5 minutes right. of him just singing this song. And it's so mean in spirit, but childish.
Yeah.
You know, and so it lets us know right off the bat, we're dealing with somebody who's ignorant. We're dealing with somebody who's obviously prejudiced, who has no compassion for the position of the slave, who definitely has no respect for the position of the slave. He wants to be bowed down. He tells all the slaves to refer to him as master, even though he has no right. ownership at all whatsoever.
He's basically the second overseer in command. Mm-hmm. He's not even the head overseer.
Right. So we see the psychosis that goes on when you're dealing with that kind of person who himself, for what it's worth, is a field hand. He works mm-hmm. in the field. Mm-hmm. You know, he might be overseeing slaves, but he's not doing, his job is not glamorous.
Right.
You know,
he wouldn't be no manager
at all. You know what I'm saying? He wouldn't be in any kind. I mean, he's not in a position of power as it is. So we see that psychosis with him juxtaposed against Platt. Solomon. When I say Solomon, when I say Platt, I mean Solomon. Yeah. It's the same character. Then I don't want to tell too much of it. The situation between Tidbits, I forget what they call him, and Solomon, it comes to a head. And Solomon has to leave the plantation. So his master sells him to a new master. And he said, I don't want to sell you to him. He's a hard man. He's known. He's proud to call himself a nigger breaker. And this was the character of Master Epps, played by Michael Fassbender, who will probably be nominated for an Academy Award.
Yeah, I was going to say with his first master, it's just, you know, the scene where he doesn't want to split up the family. early on.
Right, at the underground black market slave auction.
He actually is asking and pleading with Paul Giamatti's character, hey, can I, let me just keep them together. Because you're like, oh, this guy actually has some kind of compassion. And he's trying to protect his asset in Platt before he sells them off to Michael Fassbender's character. Fassbender's character. You know, Platt tries to explain to him who he is and what he knows of what he's gone through. And he's like, I don't want to know. I can tell that you are an exceptional Negro, which this term is thrown around a few times in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like, I can't, you know, I had to pass on my debt.
Yeah. And for me in that moment, when he called him, he said, you know, I can't hear your story, Platt, but for whatever the case may be, you are an exceptional nigger. It brought me back to the idea that white folks who participated in slavery, especially those who grew up on plantations and did not know any other way of life because they came down from a lineage, of slave owners. There is this true belief that black people are somehow a different species than they are. So when they come across one who is as intelligent or more intelligent than them, not only is it more intimidating, but it's a fascination. It's unbelievable that it's possible. And that's part of the post-traumatic slave disorder. You actually, even though you know good and well, everything in your common sense tells you that you're dealing with another human being. You've been raised in an environment that has taught you something is inherently inferior about this human being to the point where I don't have to consider them a human being.
They're cattle.
Right. Even though they're showing me all the same emotions and traits of a human,
mm-hmm.
they still have more of the ability of a beast than they do of a human, which to me is very, very poignant in the scene with Eliza. So back to Eliza and her two kids, right? She loses her kids. She goes to the new masters what's his name again? Not Fassbender, the other guy.
Oh, Cumberbatch.
Cumberbatch. So she's at, and that's not his name in the film. but she's at, this is the good master. She's at his plantation. And she's weeping when she arrives. And his wife says, oh, why is she crying? The mistress of the plantation says, why is she crying? He said, oh, she just was separated from her children. And she says, oh, poor woman. And then she says, go on and get some rest, dear. Go get some rest. In a few days, your children will be a memory. As if it's just no big deal.
And he wants, because like, you bitch.
Right.
Like, really?
Right.
And this woman's standing there with her kids.
Right. And she's the nice mistress. But that's the mentality. Like, it's no big deal because they're not actually human.
Mm. And then we get into the evil slave master.
Right. So Michael Fassbender's character, Master Epps and Mistress Epps, we first have to talk about the level of dysfunction in his marriage. We do not get any indication, and I'm hoping as we get through the actual narrative, we get the background. We get no indication as to how this man has become a plantation owner. We don't know if it's through his marriage. We don't know if he was already a plantation owner and he just married a woman. But his wife and he have a horrible relationship. They have a bad relationship. She has no respect for him. He's an alcoholic. He obviously has a wandering eye. He has a sick, twisted desire to play around with his slaves in the sense that he gets drunk. He decides he wants to have a little party. He will wake his slaves up in the middle of the night. We don't know what time. And ask them to dance. Make them dance.
Mm-hmm.
For him to watch. Slaves
play some music and he just like, yeah, dance. Mm-hmm. Why ain't y'all dancing? Ain't y'all happy? I'm like, you just woke these fools up after a whole day of labor.
And they're going to have to get up at the crack of dawn tomorrow. Or today, mm-hmm. and work again. You're not going to give them extra time to sleep.
Of course not.
And so we see how crazy his wife is because the character Patsy, played by, again, that actress Lupita Nyong'o, when they're having this dance, most of the slaves are tired. They're tired. They're not really dancing. Patsy's young, and I guess she likes to dance. And so she gets in the middle of the circle of the slaves and starts spinning and dancing and smiling, actually enjoying herself. And we notice Master Epps noticing her, enjoying watching her dance. And Mistress Epps picks up a decanter, those old glass decanters that people would hold liquor in, and just throws it at Patsy, throws it in her face. And it's like a brick. You know, those decanters are thick. They're heavy.
Yeah, ain't no Hollywood action where it just shatter on her
no,
face.
No, it's not.
Just a tink.
Like, just a boom. It's like throwing a brick at somebody and just knocks her to the ground and tells her, you sell her. You sell her now. And he tells his wife in front of all his slaves, I would get rid of you before I sell her.
And she brings in the most. She's the best cotton picker on his plantation.
Yes.
By far.
Yes. Because when the slaves pick cotton on Master Epps' plantation, they're weighed at the end. He said the average man can pick 200 pounds.
Mm-hmm. The average slave can pick 200 pounds of cotton a day.
Patsy's picking 500 plus every day. And so he calls her the queen of the field.
Yeah, you a nigger amongst niggers.
A nigger amongst niggers. And from that moment, she is favored in his eye, not to mention he is ridiculously attracted to her.
Yeah, I mean, and you see all the brothers lined up, and these, you know, fairly, you know, big sized guys, they're picking 240, 280. She's small.
Itty bitty.
And you're like 500 pounds?
Yeah, she's speeding through the field picking up cotton. So he's sure enough not getting rid of her ever at all. But notice this triangle that is created. So he favors her for the work that she does on the plantation. Plus, he's attracted to her. His wife can't stand her at all. So her life from that point on is in a catch-22. It's damned because he's never going to get rid of her because she's such a good worker. But his wife will never respect her or treat her nicely. I mean, throughout the film, we see her do all kind of, she goes up to her, she cuts her in the face, like just does random shit to her just to fuck with her because she doesn't like her. That situation in and of itself is crazy. So you have to, for the mistress of the plantation, you're married to a man who is financially successful, but he's psychotic. He's an alcoholic. And he's going to sleep with slaves. And you're going to have to deal with it. Because he's telling you he'll value them over you. So what choices do you have?
Right. Before we move off this topic, let's speak on the white slave owner who has a black wife.
Yeah. So Alfre Woodard in this film is interesting. She is a slave who has moved up the social hierarchy of slavery. So she would be a character on the same order as Eliza, who we meet originally, who lost her two children, but was favored by her master and was supposed to be freed upon his death. And Patsy, who was favored by her master because of his attraction to her and her hard work. But in her situation, Alfre Woodard's master was into her so much, he just said to hell with everybody and marries her. And makes her the mistress of the plantation. And so this was interesting because this is something that we don't hear a lot about when it comes to the history of slavery. You know, Edward P. Jones, who wrote the novel The Known World, was probably the first person to put in the mainstream the fact that there were black slave owners during
slavery.
The 19th century during slavery. He was the first person to bring that to light to me in his novel, The Known World. But I personally had not heard many stories of a master marrying a slave, fathering children with a slave and, you know, favoring a slave and having many children with that slave and keeping. I mean, that's we known about that. But marrying one, this was a new one on me.
Right. To the point where, she talks about her situation and that she was a house slave and, you know, did all the cooking and all that. And she wasn't going to go back and that this white man just loved her and adored her.
Mm-hmm.
And they deal with white people basically criticizing them and criticizing him for, you know, why did you marry this darky and all this stuff? And he seems to be rich enough that ain't nobody going to really challenge him. Mm-hmm. They'll just voice their displeasure about it.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not killing him.
No. No, not at all. And she tells Patsy basically to find comfort in the fact that your master favors you. You know, And this is prior to us seeing Patsy and Master Epps actually have a sexual relationship. But Patsy can't do it. And Master Epps is too crazy. There's no sort of love situation. For him, it's a matter of control. It's his property. And even if he is desiring her, it's just like, I'm going to take it whether you give it to me or not. And it's everything about his interaction with people is just violent. Mm-hmm. Even the way he speaks to folks, there's a violent undertone to it all. It's just filled with venom.
Right. And you have Brad Pitt's character, who is a Canadian, who is helping out Master Epps build.
He's like a contractor.
Yeah. And he has a different viewpoint. He doesn't agree with slavery
at all.
You know, but of course, he's in the South, and you can't really voice your displeasure about slavery if you want to live.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting because he and Master Epps had a discussion about slavery. Master Epps asks him, you know, what's your viewpoint on it? Go speak on it some more. And he tells him, like, how can you really deal with this? Mm-hmm. You know, this is kind of barbaric and all that. You know, it gets to a point where Master Epps is like, all right, you need to shut your mouth right now.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to hear anymore.
We even actually get to see, and I won't say a white slave, but you basically get a white man who works on the field alongside the niggas.
Yeah, he essentially is an indentured servant. Mm-hmm. He is somebody who was an overseer, had a problem with alcohol, found himself in debt, and now has to work his debt off in the field. Aside the slaves. Mm-hmm. He even stays in the slave quarters with the slaves.
Can't even pick 100 pounds of cotton.
No. And oh, we forgot this part. The evil part also about Master Epps. So all the bales of cotton are weighed every day. You have to pick at least what you picked the day before or you get whipped. So that's just a standard with his slave. They weigh in. He finds out what they weighed. He asks, what did they weigh the day before? If they got at least what they got the day before, they're good to go for the evening. If they didn't, 100 lashes. Yep.
If you pick under 200, you're getting 100 lashes.
Yeah, violent. Just violent. He was just violent in his entire mindset and how he trained his slaves. But it again, the psychosis. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
And a lot of this goes back to our next topic on this is that Christianity was used as a weapon during this time period.
Yeah.
You see periods like with Platt's first master, where they have periods where they'll sit around and read the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And that version is kind of like just reading it as, you know, for everybody to get the Christian word. But when you get to Master Epps' plantation and he reads it, his interpretation is that he, the white man, is God, and the people who have to serve him, who serve God, are the slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And basically pointing out, you see in the Bible that it says that the slaves love their master.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pointing to that, and that God has the right to punish his children if he feels so necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like, wow, really?
Mm-hmm. And, like, this is not something that's news to us. We know that Christianity was yielded as a weapon of keeping slaves subservient. But it was kind of crazy watching the way he would utilize, like, he's preaching to his slaves. This is Sunday service. You know, this is Sunday service. And this is what he's telling them, constantly beating in their heads. Like, it's totally my job to beat you if you don't listen to me. It's my responsibility, ordained by the Lord himself.
Yeah, and it's even, he's that nuts that he gets to a point where, I guess, a season where his crop isn't doing so well. Mm-hmm. And he has to lend out the slaves because he can't afford to keep them all. Lends them out to that tobacco farm so they can do some work.
Mm-hmm.
He basically blames his situation on his crops on his slaves.
Yeah. He like, it's y'all fault. Plague.
Yeah. Like, with your hateful ass, it's they fault. Mm-hmm. Okay. He's like, I mean, nuts.
He's crazy. And to me, that's probably the scariest situation of all. You know, we've had conversations here at the table before about mental illness. And we had this conversation a little bit last night. We don't know how, you know, there's different types of people in the world, of course, and people go about doing things a different way. We don't know how many slave owners dealt with mental illness. We don't know how many slave owners were pedophiles. We don't know how many slave owners, you know, just were, sadists, masochists, you know what I'm saying?
And just enjoyed torturing and killing their slaves just because.
There are tales of that. There are stories of slave masters who tortured slaves and had, like, you know, dens of terror in their house, and that's what they bought slaves for. But you don't hear about it often. But this film showcased, you know, you don't know who you're going to come across and why. It goes back to the brother who ran off the boat when he saw his master. Like, he knew whatever his master's situation was. He was comfortable and okay with dealing with that. The fear was going south to somebody who he didn't know.
Yeah.
And not knowing what to expect in that kind of circumstance.
I mean, it gets crazy like that. I mean, you even get the whipping scene, which is probably the hardest scene to watch in this movie. What's the girl's character?
Patsy.
Yeah. Patsy basically gets whipped because, Mistress Epps is not letting her bathe. She's not giving her any soap to bathe with. She's saying she stink. So she had to go somewhere and,
she goes to, Alfre Woodard's plantation to get some soap.
Now, mind you, Master Epps is looking for her ass. So he's damn near threatening every slave he sees. Like, you know where she's at. Tell me where she at. Going that crazy. And then, of course, he finds her, is upset. Mr. Zepps comes out. Oh, she need to get whipped.
Whip the life out of her, was what she said.
And with his mental issues and his love for Patsy, he can't do it. I mean, he's standing there, all the slaves around him, wife staring right at him, hands him the whip. He can't do it.
And so he asked Platt to do it. And this was one of the hardest scenes to watch because we've watched Platt and Patsy not build a relationship, so to speak, but there's an alliance between the two of them. Mm-hmm. They both understand each other and know the challenges that they're faced being here. Both of them having a special sort of relationship with the master, in a sense, because like the master before, Master Epps recognizes that Platt is different from the other slaves. And so he allows him or entrusts him with different responsibilities that he doesn't give the rest of the slaves. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, his thing for Patsy. And it's the heartbreaking part of it is that early on in their arrival there, Patsy asks Platt to kill her. And he's like, why would you ask me to do that? It would condemn my soul to hell, you know. And she's just like, it would be mercy because there's going to be no, there's going to be nothing but pain for my life here. Mm-hmm. And so if I were dead, that would be merciful. You know, you would be showing me great mercy. And he couldn't do it. And so when he's asked to beat her, it's almost like it came full circle. Like this is the worst possible thing you could be asking me to do right now is to beat my friend.
Right. And he beats her and, you know, he's basically not whipping her hard enough for the white folk. So he pulls a gun out on Platt.
The master.
Like, yeah. Whip her like you mean it or I will start shooting any nigga I see in here. And he just like, okay. And starts really whipping her. Mm-hmm. And the director, we get to see all sides of it because we see her from her face and the pain. Because when the whipping starts getting notched up, she reacts. I mean, you can hear it, everything. And we even get the back shot of it, of seeing the whips take their effect on this chocolate woman. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it's...
Yeah, she's a beautiful woman, a beautiful ebony hue. And the whip, once Platt at some point drops the whip, he can't do it anymore. But he tries to keep it from Master Epps. And at this point, Master Epps is just crazy. He done gone off the deep end. So he tries to whip her to death, basically. And they show with every lash, her skin is taken off. We going right down to the meat and the blood. You know?
It's
evil. It's the craziest, most evil thing you will probably ever see. Because you know that this man who was beating her has this weird, crazy, riled up passion for this woman. He needs her. As far as work is concerned, because she's the greatest worker on his plantation. And because his crazy, weird, lustful passion for her makes him not trust her for mm-hmm. some strange reason. And it's because he just knows he's crazy and he's evil. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to be around him. His mm-hmm. own wife don't want to be around mm-hmm. him. And like it's like he's beating her because of the way she makes him feel, because of all the good that she does. You know what I mean? It's ridiculous. It's completely, it's unnecessary. It's not even prompted. It's just something he can do, something he's doing because he can do it.
Yeah, and this movie is just, it's riddled with that. I'm just seeing Platt's character deal with all this. And you can tell early throughout the movie, it's just getting harder for him.
Yeah.
I mean, one instance, he thinks about escaping and he runs into some folk who are going to hang some slaves just cause. Mm-hmm. And luckily he has a necklace showing that he is owned.
Mm-hmm.
He's safe
mm-hmm.
if he hurries on.
But he tells Master Epps in that final beating of Patsy at the end, he says, "You're going to have to answer for these sins." And the master is like, "What sins? You know, a man does what he wants with his property." So again, just the complete and total psychosis of the fact that people who worked on plantations were beaten to the point where they could not function as actual human beings. They couldn't think of themselves as human beings. Because at the end, of course, Solomon is rescued. And when he's talking, he's rescued by a friend of his.
We meet in the very beginning.
Right. And he's in the way the movie sets it up. This man actually introduces him to the two men who end up kidnapping him. It's not that way in the narrative. But Brad Pitt, he asked Brad Pitt at some point to write a letter home for him explaining his situation. We have no idea if Brad Pitt actually does it, even though he agrees to do it. And he tells him, "It scares me." He says, "You know, what you're asking to me, it scares me. And not just for you, for me." He says, "But if I do it and something were to happen where you were able to get free, it would have not only been my privilege, it would have been my duty." So we find out Brad Pitt character, he actually does write the letter. And so when the sheriff comes to get Platt and take him back to his friend to take him home, he starts asking, you know, he's like, "You go by the name of Platt. Do you have another name?" "Yes, it's Solomon." "Do you have a family?" "Yes, I have two children, Margaret and Alonzo. My wife, her name is Ann." And when he's saying this, Master Epps comes up and he's like, "What? What is he talking about?" Like, never had any thought that this man had a life.
I really didn't care.
Right.
And you see his pride come back because that, you know, mm-hmm. he learned. I mean, you learn through this movie that you have to keep your knowledge and your skills that you have to yourself.
You keep your mouth shut.
Mm-hmm. His first master, he kind of learned the price. Since then, are you educated? No. Can you read? No. Like, I'm not telling you nothing. I'm just a regular slave. I don't know nothing.
Mm-mm.
So having to hide who you are
mm-hmm.
amongst these people, he's basically playing. He's an actor. The director said, the guy's an actor.
It's truly wearing the mask. Mm-hmm. You cannot be who you actually are, especially if you're somebody who was never enslaved before and who actually is educated and has worked. You can't, nobody wants mm-hmm. to know that.
So when he's speaking it at the end, it's almost like he's letting it all out and you can tell, like, mm-hmm. I've been holding all this back. And so when one of the saddest scenes is once he's free and he's about to get on the carriage,
Patsy runs out
and calls him, and just their eye contact is so palpable. I was so split in my feelings at that moment because I'm happy for him that he's going home, essentially, but he's leaving all of them behind.
Yeah, and therein lies another issue that affects the mental aspect of slavery. So if you are fortunate enough to get out of this circumstance, and it makes me think about every slave that was ever successfully manumitted, first of all, you're still in danger because this black market exists. Mm-hmm. And of course, you become a lot more aware of those circumstances having gone through it. Any slave that was ever successfully manumitted had to leave behind a lot of people who were still in this circumstance. And throughout the film, they show one slave actually die in the field. Mm-hmm. And we know that experience was probably more frequent. You know, that happened more often than slaves getting free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who were born into slavery and died as slaves. You know, but if you were actually ever freed, even though you were probably happy as I don't know what to get your freedom, you had to think about everybody who you had lived your life with and interacted with who were still in that predicament. And there's really nothing you can do for them to help them gain their freedom. And it makes me think about every slave narrative I've ever come across where somebody has gotten freed and has tried to save money or get into a position where they could buy the freedom of other family members over time. How hard would that be? You know, to leave those people behind. You want to take them all with you and say, let's just get out of here together.
I mean, this movie is, it's awesome. My mother exposed me to a lot of this early on as a child, so maybe it was a little bit easier for me to digest than for some people, but this movie was great. I actually would go see it again.
Me too.
I mean, that's how good it is as a film.
Yeah.
It's not just brutal, it's an actual film.
Yeah.
And Steve McQueen has done a great job. I hope he gets nominated for Best Director. I don't know if it'll be for Best Picture. We never know when it comes to Hollywood and all that, but he deserves a Best Director nod for this for sure.
Yeah.
I would recommend anybody who hasn't seen it to go out and see it. The story is not told as often as it's made to be seen, but I enjoyed it, and I'm pubbing this movie to death.
Yeah, it was an awesome film, and I know I use the word awesome all the damn time, but in this situation, I genuinely mean it. It actually is awesome, to the point where I'm going to deviate a little bit. We had a friend of ours who had to walk out the film because his viewing experience was ruined by black folks in the audience acting a fool in the midst of the movie. Now, we all know part of the black movie going experience sometimes, a lot of the times, is call and response. Black folks love to talk to the screen. It's just what we do. But this is, and let me not generalize and say it's what we do, because I don't always talk to the screen. That's not the case. But it's what a lot of us do. Mm-hmm. I'll say that. This is a serious film, and I think it's uncomfortable to watch. And I think for a lot of us that have not been exposed to this kind of aspect of our history, it's really uncomfortable to watch, mm-hmm. because you may not have a foundation for understanding all that's going on. And again, because the brutality is more mental, it's more psychological than physical, sometimes that's more difficult to watch. And, you know, if you find yourself in a situation where you're in the theater and folks is acting a fool, I would encourage you to quiet them down. And tell them, everybody be quiet and let's watch this. You know what I'm saying? Because for me, a lot of times when people have that kind of response, it's just because they are truly uncomfortable. A lot of it is ignorance. I'm not going to gloss over that at all. Some folks are just straight up ignorant, mm-hmm. and don't know how to respond.
Mm-hmm. But with this particular movie, which my mother also said that she had the same kind of audience experience, mm-hmm. which was shocking.
Yeah, Chris and I both had completely quiet audiences. Yeah,
very quiet. And when it ended, there was no clapping. There was no people getting up talking. It was pin drop silent, mm-hmm. when that movie ended.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, understand that sometimes for a lot of our folks, especially the ones who have not been exposed as much and who don't know their history, they don't have a foundation for this like they should. It's just uncomfortable. And, you know, people deal with discomfort differently. Some people cry through it. Some people laugh through it, mm-hmm. you know, and try to bear with your people. You know what I mean? When if you go to see this film in a predominantly black theater, if you go to a predominantly white theater, chances are you might not have as much ruckus. I don't know. It depends probably on the age group of the people.
You might be surprised what you hear.
Yeah, you might be really surprised. And like I was explaining to some friends of ours when we were having this conversation about the black experience in film going, you know, we're not privy to what an all white audience does. Because they're very aware if even one of us is in the room, and mm-hmm. that will change the rhythm of the room. So we have no idea what would happen. We have no idea what an all white audience does in the viewing of Django Unchained. Mm-hmm. You know, we have no idea what that experience was like because we're not privy to that. But you know, if you can, the one thing I do know about this film, it's being treated to me very much like an art house film, and it's in select theaters. So if you can see this in a predominantly black theater, in a theater within the community, support it, go see it, period, but go see it if you can.
Well, thank y'all for tuning into this, first episode of The Lion and the Ram, brought to you by the Black Is Network.
Yes, sir.
You can find our podcast and all the Black Is Network podcasts on Stitcher and iTunes Radio. Just do a search for Black Is. You can also go to our website, www.blackisonline.com. Besides this podcast, you can check out The Break, Brother Lemon Sports Happy Hour, Culture Connection, a lot of great podcasts. And support the other podcasts that are out there. I support your own movement is great. A lot of good podcasts is out there, so please support them as well. You want to hit us up, you can leave a voicemail, 323-455-4219. You can hit us up on Twitter, at Black Is Online. Contact us on Facebook, at Black Is Magazine.
And that is all.
Yep, so let us know what you think of the movie.
Please do. Peace out, y'all.
Later.